So currently, I think the best all-round rifle you could get would be either the 6.5 Creedmoor or the 6.5 PRC. I would recommend the 6.5 Creedmoor east of the Mississippi and the 6.5 PRC west of the Mississippi. Every bullet's going to perform differently in everyone's gun. And there's a phenomenon in reloading, and it's physics, basically. When you increase your bullet weight, you usually have to decrease your powder weight because there's more resistance from the bullet.
Okay.
Therefore, there's more inertia to overcome, and then the powder builds up more pressure. So you actually use less powder for a heavier bullet than you use for a lighter bullet. When they create the chamber in the barrel for the case and they cut or button the rifling, there are machining marks in the barrel, in the chamber, from when they create it. And when you're shooting, you're burnishing those flaws, those machine marks in the barrel, and you're placing copper in the pores, in the lands, in the grooves of the barrel. So you're basically seasoning it. A lot of people just like to shoot when there's no wind because it's easier and they feel better about themselves. You need to go out when you get 10, 15 mile an hour winds and realize that sometimes you have to hold off the target. You know, sometimes you're holding in, not even on the deer, because you're shooting across a canyon and it's consistent wind, so you're confident of your shot. But you may be holding in front of the deer in order to hit the deer in the vitals, right?
Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Just before we roll into this episode, I want to talk to you about a couple things. As always, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, main sponsor of the show. Use promo code John Stallone, save 20% on your whole order. They got some awesome stuff. So get yourself some shooting bags, a glassing pad. Check out some of the stuff that they're working on. Also, I want you to check out Lacusa. Lacusa makes wild hunted American whitetail leather goods, like wallets, card holders, stuff like that. It's a really neat deal. I got mine about a month ago, and I really love it. It's nice to know that your whitetail hide's not just going in the garbage or being left out in the field, and it's being turned into something useful and will last you a very, very long time. If you use promo code John Stallone on your purchase, you will receive a discount. And a couple other things. One, you know, I know you guys heard me say a million times, please go on iTunes, give us a review, helps me keep this free. And lastly, I just want to touch on all the craziness that's going on in the world. It's really important for us hunters to stick together. They are really heavily coming for hunting. We're seeing it all over the place. It's popping up in every state where they're trying to chip away at hunting rights and change things up. So if you want to keep hunting as special as it is to us now and have it be in our heritage and for the generations to come, then learn to be better with your fellow hunter and learn to stick up and fight for what's right. Thank you. Let's jump into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about rifles. We're going to geek out a little bit about that stuff and shooting. And got my buddy David Mayer on the phone. And I don't really know anybody, actually, that owns more rifles than you and knows more technical stuff than you do. I'm sure there are, but you're my go-to when it comes to gun questions. So I got a bunch of questions sent at me. I got probably 30 questions sent at me, but I'm going to kind of trim it down to 5 to 6 or so, and we'll go from there. Anyway, give us a little rundown about yourself, Dave.
All right, first of all, in my defense, one of my favorite coffee mugs, I have a saying that says, in my defense, I was left unsupervised and the gun store was open. So when I'm not supervised, I tend to buy actions and barrels and build guns.
Yeah.
So yeah. Good morning, John. Glad to be on. I'm a competitive shooter for the last year and a half in the Precision Rifle Series in the PRS series. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it, but you can go on YouTube and or Google PRS Precision Rifle Series, and there's a couple different organizations that put that on. So oddly enough, I tried to get your cousin Anthony shooting Phoenix Bags and your cousin Joe all to jump in at the same time, and I jumped in first, and I'm I'm in the deep end now. They're still in the shallow end. So yeah, I got in pretty heavy. So I was in the military for 24 years, didn't learn anything about how to shoot, which is counter to what most people would think because I was in the Air Force and flying airplanes. So I'd qualify once a year on pistols or rifles, but didn't really learn anything in the military. Most of my knowledge is gained from my personal shooting. You know, I started out with the consummate, you know, Christmas story, Daisy Red Rider. You know, put my eye out and graduated to Crossman 760 Pump Master, and then, you know, continued on to there.
Nice.
So, yeah, I'd love to answer some questions, and I'll probably have a few questions of my own.
Awesome. This is a question that gets thrown to me all the time, and I know sending this at you is going to be really difficult. It's kind of going to be difficult for you to answer. But if you had to choose one caliber for hunting, what would it be and why?
Well, I would break that down into two categories. I would say east of the Mississippi and west of the Mississippi.
Okay.
If you're east of the Mississippi, usually you're not going to be doing long range shooting unless you're in like a bean field, you know, and more than likely to be shooting at hogs and whitetail. If you're west of the Mississippi, you're likely going to be shooting long range, cross mountainous terrain, wide open prairies, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So currently I think the best all round rifle you could get would be either the 6.5 Creedmoor or the 6.5 PRC. I would recommend the 6.5 Creedmoor east of the Mississippi and the 6.5 PRC west of the Mississippi. And I own several of both those calibers.
Several hundred of them. Which is crazy, I think. I could see owning multiple rifles with multiple calibers, but you have like, how many 6.5s do you have?
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. Exactly. I mean, you enjoy building them. You enjoy shooting. You're a big reloader and all that stuff. And we're going to get into a little bit of that, but.
But if a guy were to say, I only have enough money to buy one gun.
Yeah.
I would say, unless you're going to be hunting elk, I would say 6.5 Creedmoor will get you 95% of hunts. And I would even recommend a 6.5 Creedmoor for an elk hunt if you limit your range inside of 300 yards.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, well, Anthony's son used your PRC, right, for his elk?
Anthony did use my 6.5 PRC with the Berger 156 EOLs, and his son dropped it. It went down so fast, they didn't even realize they hit it. It just disappeared. And it was one of the more difficult shots for a high powerful rifles in that their shot was under 100 yards. Oftentimes when you shoot under 100 yards with a high velocity gun, the bullets sometimes fail because they're just they going so fast.
They don't do what they're supposed to do. Yeah.
Yeah, they explode on the shoulder. But that bullet and that combination performed perfectly.
Yeah.
And again, that was a 6.5 PRC, and his son was shooting it. And we can get into that caliber if you want the benefits. Of that rifle.
We'll figure that all out here in a minute. But it's like, and I remember, so I ended up having to use Joe's 6.5 Creedmoor. This was before I owned one. I shot one of my elk with it. I had to shoot it three times.
And right. I think some. If I remember right, you used the 143 LDX and you hit it on the shoulder, right?
The first shot was on the shoulder, and then the second was in the lungs, and the third was him going away in the backstrap, unfortunately, straight down the middle.
In defense of the caliber, I've also been on many hunts where I've witnessed shooters having to hit elk with 338 Lapuas, 300 Win Mags, three times. I mean, elk just absorb energy like nobody's business.
Right.
And essentially, oftentimes, they're dead on their feet.
Right.
They have so much blood and so much mass that
they're going anyway.
They're just big animals.
I've yet to see one that was hit with my 300 rum, not just anchor right there, though. Thank God. That's why we call that gun the Punisher.
Yeah, on both ends of that gun.
No, actually, you've shot that gun, right?
Well, I used to shoot a 300 Weatherby, and
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. That 300 Weatherby. My uncle has one that I shot. My uncle Luigi. I don't know if you ever met him or not, but holy shit, does that gun kick like a mule? Like knocks the freaking your teeth out. My 300, I don't know, just the way that it, or if it's the brake or what, the way that it was built. And it's really light. It's 7.5 pounds.
Yeah, you have that Huber brake, the Huber brake.
Yeah, I do.
That's a good brake.
You know, at the time, 10-year-old daughter shot her coos deer with it, no problem, you know?
Yeah.
It's been a really good gun for me. I really like it. Some people don't like it, especially because of the two-stage trigger and all that, but...
That's not the caliber. That's not a gun. That's a trigger. Unfortunately, though, you're looking at almost $2, probably almost $3
it's
around.
Stupid expensive. Shoot that. Yeah. Stupid expensive. But I'm not a shooter.
Don't get a lot of practice.
If there's no fur in my scope, I'm not pulling triggers. So. But anyway, so let's talk a little bit about load, seeing we've kind of opened that door up a little bit. Now, most of the people listening probably don't do their own reloading, but I think it's kind of important to learn a little bit about it, and then we can transition into what somebody could look for finding the right load for their rifle and all that stuff like that. So what are some of the things that you do to develop a load for, let's just stick with the PRC, I'm sure the concept of developing the load is pretty much the same from rifle to rifle, but or caliber to caliber.
So when you're developing a load, what you're looking for, a couple of things. You're looking for obviously accuracy, and you're also looking for consistency in the bullets, in the rounds. So when I develop a load, I do all my own reloading for all my guns, and I tune my ammunition to my gun. Okay. So what you're looking to do is when you shoot a rifle, there are harmonics in the rifle. And there's, when you pull the trigger, there's a microsecond for the firing pin to drop. Mm-hmm. That timing detonates the primer, and the primer detonates the powder. The powder expands the gas, and the bullet goes down the barrel. That initial explosion creates a shock wave, a vibration that goes down the barrel and back. Mm-hmm. It goes back and forth about 8 times by the time your bullet actually exits the barrel.
Wow, that
in
fast.
That time, okay. Yeah, so in that duration, your barrel is actually moving harmonically, okay? And what you're trying to do is find a load that is timed to your barrel, and that bullet exits the barrel when that harmonic meets a node that is like in the middle of the node. Kind of think of it as your barrel whipping up and down. You want to be consistent where that load is exiting at the same time where that barrel is. And that'll give you small groups. Now, additionally, you're also looking for a consistency in your load, which we call standard deviation and extreme spread. So your standard deviation, you look at an average of the velocity, and your extreme spread would be, say you shot 10 shots, extreme spread would be your lowest velocity and your highest velocity.
Okay.
Inside of 400 or 500 yards, your extreme spread, standard deviations are not going to impact your bullet trajectory in a hunting situation when you're shooting at a zone that may be 9 inches to 18 inches on an elk. Mm-hmm. Once you get out towards 800, 900, 1,000 yards, those deviations in the feet per second that bullet is traveling can be enough to completely miss your target. For example, say you're shooting a 6.5 Creedmoor, you're shooting a 140 grain bullet, it's probably going to exit the barrel somewhere around 2,700 feet per second, depending on whether you got a 20-inch barrel or a 26-inch barrel. A 50 to 60-foot extreme spread could be enough to completely miss a target at 1,000 yards, which in the precision shooting world, you just missed a steal. No big deal. You miss a point and maybe you drop a place or two in the standings for the match. But when you're hunting elk or deer, you've either missed the deer or wounded the deer. And so when I'm looking for a load, I'm looking for a group inside less than a half inch. I prefer a quarter inch. And I'm looking for standard deviations in PRS. I'm looking for a standard deviation around 4 or 5 with an extreme spread of, 10 to 12. And I can achieve that with the calibers that I shoot. Okay. In a hunting rifle, I'm looking for anything half inch, 3/4 inch is good enough. And then I'm looking
that's what at 100 yards, you're saying?
Yeah, at 100 yards. Okay. And I'm looking at any extreme spreads of less than like 20 or 30. Because when I'm hunting, although I can hit a target at 12, 1300 yards,
you're not shooting
good conditions.
Yeah. You're not
shooting. I'm not shooting at an animal typically at 1,000 yards due to environmental conditions, wind, and things like that. That, you know, at 1,000 yards, it takes my bullet about 1.7 seconds to get there. Well, he can move in that 1.5 seconds, or I may misjudge the wind, which now I've wounded the animal. So I prefer to get within 500 yards when I'm shooting at an actual animal. So,
gotcha. And this was brought up a couple of times. So, and I think you kind of started talking about it, or I might be misunderstanding what it actually means, but ladder testing.
Okay. So a ladder test is a way of developing loads to find an accuracy node in your rifle. There are usually have several accuracy nodes. And what a ladder test is this is only for reloaders. You develop a load. If you've never shot that caliber or that specific bullet or that specific powder, there are manuals produced by Hornady, Hodgdon, Alliant. You know, there's a lot of reloading manuals. They'll give you a baseline to say that, okay, I want to shoot, for instance, we'll stick with the Creedmoor. I want to shoot the 143 grain ELDX out of a 6.5 Creedmoor. What are the best powders? They'll give me a list of powders. A fantastic powder for the Creedmoor is Hodgdon 4350, and they'll give you a max load and a starting load. Never want to start at the max load because that max load is based on pressure testing for their gun. You always want to drop a few grains down. So what you do is, just, let's say that load is, the max load is, I just say about 38 grains for a Creedmoor. You might want to start around 36, 37, depending on your experience. And your started baseline is to say you're going to start at 37.0 grains, and you're going to load five at that weight. And then you're going to increase by 2.2. So the next one would be 38.2, then 38.4, 38.6. And you're going to keep going up until you hit the max for your gun. And you'll start getting pressure signs and things like that. And as you shoot these five rounds, you're looking at your groups to see as these groups come together. You'll see as you're increasing your load, typically rifles like to be full, or cartridges like to be full of powder. So the closer you get to 100% of filling the capacity of that case, you're going to start getting lower standard deviations, and you're going to start to see your groups come together. Right. Okay. And then you keep shooting, and then you're going to see your groups open up, and you just hit a node there. And now your barrel is harmonics is working against you now, and the groups are going to go open back up, and then you're going to keep increasing your powder. You're going to find another node, and then you're going to see your groups going down. So once you find the groups, if you're hunting, you know, that are small, then you're probably set. Now I further that I now chrono those. And I'm more concerned about finding the load that I have the smallest standard deviations in extreme spreads, because then I can go back and start tuning that load based on bullet seating depth. And that's another discussion.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
we can have.
You could go down a million rabbit holes, I'm sure.
Right.
Like one of the things that kind of came up to me that, like, I hearing you talk about this, and I'm thinking about how I develop arrows and whatnot, is you right. always have to have a starting point. So to me, it sounds like you say, hey, I want to shoot this grain of bullet, right? And because I want to hunt this type of animals with this bullet, with this cartridge. And then you start, you know, start to develop the powder, you know, one way or another, like you said, you know, testing here, and here. But in all reality, like, so the way I'm hearing it, if you, let's say you're shooting a 150 grain bullet and it took, you know, you shot 36 grains of powder or whatever, 37 or 36 and a half, 37. And then a 37 was your best group, but you went all the way up to like 38 and a half, right? And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. Would that mean that if you went a little bit heavier bullet, let's say you went to a 155 grain, would you be able to shoot the 30? 8.5, and it would, you know what I'm saying? Like, it, is it that, do you have to keep going back and forth to figure that out? Is, I guess, what I'm trying to, in a roundabout way?
Every bullet's going to perform differently in everyone's gun. And there's a phenomenon in reloading, and it's physics, basically. When you increase your bullet weight, you usually have to decrease your powder weight because there's more resistance from the bullet.
Okay.
Therefore, there's more inertia to overcome, and then the powder builds up more pressure. So you actually use less powder for a heavier bullet than you use for a lighter bullet.
Okay. Okay.
But so that would be a ladder test. Right. So that would be a ladder test for people that reload. But I would imagine most of your audience probably doesn't reload.
Right. And I wanted to get into that.
So they're looking to develop a load for their rifle. Mm-hmm. Well, machining, CNC, optics, ballistic software, they have come a long way in the last 20 years. And so there is a product that you can purchase now called a barrel tuner, which fundamentally changes the game. Instead of finding a round or load that is tuned to your barrel, you can now tune your barrel to your load.
Huh.
And there's several breaks out there. Eric Cortina, Kinetic Research, Without Warning. There are tuners, and some are a tuner and some are a break. And the way it basically works is the tuners are a weight that you put on the end of your barrel that is threaded so that you can adjust for that weight to go forward or aft on the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking like thousands, adjustments of thousands of an inch. And you're essentially changing the harmonics of your barrel to tune to the harmonics of your load. And so I highly recommend those to people. Those are becoming more prevalent in precision rifle shooting, F-class shooting, where people are able to tune the barrel
mm-hmm.
to the load. And so the way that would work is, okay, let's just say you own some type of Remington 700 based rifle, right? The Action 700, and you go up to Sportsman's Warehouse, and you buy yourself a Browning or a Christensen Arms or whatever. You put that tuner barrel, that tuner or tuner brake on the end of the barrel, get your ammo, say you buy, five boxes, if you can find it nowadays.
Right.
Hornady Precision Match 143 ELDX, and you just sit down and start shooting, right? You shoot two or three shots, and see where that group is. You adjust the tuner brake two lines, you rotate it, you shoot again. And that group is going to move. It's either going to get bigger, smaller, or stay the same. And you keep changing, you keep adjusting that tuner, and eventually you will find a node where you're basically going to get one hole. And it all depends basically on the quality of the action in the barrel. I mean, if you take one of my guns with a custom action, a custom barrel, you're going to be really close. But if you buy a factory gun where the tolerances are a lot looser, you may be able to go from an inch and a half group down to a half inch group. But that tuner brake will increase the precision. There's a difference between accuracy and precision. So precision is how small your groups are. Accuracy is where those groups fall.
Right.
So you will be able to adjust the precision of that barrel with those tuners. And I've got several of them on my shooting and my hunting rifles, as well as my match rifles.
Gotcha.
And you can just get on and Google tuner brakes for rifles, and there are several. Eric Cortina, Without Warning, Kinetic Research, they're all out there. And I have all three of those, by the way, and they all three work great.
Awesome. So let's talk about the ammo itself, though. I mean, again, aside from being able to find ammo, that's a whole nother discussion. But when you're looking to like find the best, and now you just said, okay, you could tune the barrel to the bullet, but let's say I just wanted to go and find what's the best ammo for my rifle. Basically, is it just going out and buying, a box of 10 different ammo and shooting you know, setting up the same conditions, shooting 3-4 shot groups and finding which one shoots the best? Or is there a little bit shorter of a curve that, you know, than doing that, a less expensive way of doing that? Or
unless you're going to reload, no, there really isn't. Now, when you buy a brand new rifle, you have to understand that you need to season that barrel. And when you season a barrel, what you're doing is, when you buy a brand new rifle, if it's a factory rifle versus a custom hand-lapped barrel, it's going to take longer to break that barrel in. And basically what breaking a barrel is when they create the chamber in the barrel for the case and they cut or button the rifling, there are machining marks in the barrel, in the chamber, from when they create it.
Right.
And when you're shooting, you're burnishing those flaws, those machine marks in the barrel. And you're placing copper in the pores, in the lands, in the grooves of the barrel. So you're basically seasoning it. And typically a barrel is going to take about 100 rounds, you know, plus or minus, to season it. And what you'll see is the speeds will increase up to, could be at least, you know, 100 feet per second from a virgin barrel to a barrel with 100 feet. So a brand new gun is going to shoot differently than a gun with 100 rounds on it. So, I shoot 100 rounds. I'll shoot 300 rounds in a practice session. I shoot thousands of rounds a month.
Right.
But your typical hunter may not shoot 500 rounds for the life of the barrel.
Yep.
So, yeah, what you want to do is go out and look at the bullet. First, you want to determine what you're hunting, because you're not going to use the same bullet for an elk that you would use for a javelina, right?
Right.
So you got to determine what you're hunting. So you're going to decide on the bullet weight for that, right? Bullet construction has come a long way in the last 20 years. Phenomenal bullets out there. Some of the best that I recommend are the Berger bullets and the Hornady bullets. Mm-hmm. They're consistent from lot to lot, and they perform phenomenally on game. So yeah, what you want to do is you want to go out and buy that. Don't just buy one box of ammo, you know, buy several and then shoot them in your gun, find one that shoots the best. Now, every one of those boxes will have a lot number on it. You need to go find the same lot that you bought that shoots well in your gun. Because every time they change a component, they change a new one. Maybe they get a new bin of bullets from Berger. Well, that's a different lot of bullets. It's going to perform slightly different than the previous lot. So, you know, find a lot that shoots good in your gun and then just go buy as many as that specific lot that you can. If you can't find it, then, you know, you're going to have to basically retest the next lot and make sure it's still consistent. Now, again, manufacturing has come a long way in the last 20 years, and they're usually pretty close.
Yeah, pretty consistent.
But when I buy bullets by the thousands, and I buy powders by, you know, jugs.
Yeah.
And an 8-pound jug of powder may get me through 1,500 rounds. When I change that jug, it's a new lot. I go out and I test that again to make sure it's still shooting well in that rifle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to switch directions a little bit. Let's talk a little bit more about hunting and some of the things you can do. I know one of the toughest things to do is to be able to read wind. And I haven't personally, well, I haven't shot with you really that much, but Anthony shoots with you all the time. Joe shot with you. And everybody's like, Dave knows that I read wind better than anybody I know. So let's talk about reading wind. What are some of the things that you do? And what are some of the things that a guy can do to practice to get to a level like you? Obviously, you shoot so many rounds that it's, you know, it becomes second nature looking. You know, it's an experience thing. But obviously, before it was an experience thing, you had a formula in place of some sort that helped you get there.
So the best thing that you can do, so when you go hunting or when you're shooting a rifle match, there are ballistic programs out there that you can program your gun, the details of your gun, into that software. Applied Ballistics, Hornady, DOF, I think it's DOF4, Shooter, Trajection Sol. I guess pull them up my phone and see what they are. But you can program all the information. So here we got Crasol, Hornady, Ballistic, AE, Shooter, Applied Ballistics, They're all great softwares. And you can program your bullet weight, velocity, altitude, your elevation, and it's going to give you a solution to dial. It's either in what they call MOA, which is minutes of angle, which are mils or milliradians, which is broken into angles. It's not a measurement. It's actually an angle. It's a tenth. It's based on tens. And then the other one that people, I think most people use, they don't even realize it, is called IPHY. Which is probably what you use, John. You're not even realizing it.
Maybe.
But minute of angle, Everyone thinks is, oh, that's 1 inch at 100 yards. It's actually not. It's 1.046, I believe, inches per 100 yards.
Okay.
Milliradian is a tenth of an inch, or is this, I'm sorry, at 100 yards is 0.36 of an inch, or 3.6 inches at 1,000 yards. And IPHY is what everyone else uses, is like inch per 100 yards.
Okay.
Okay, so it's going to give you a ballistic solution. So let's just say I'm shooting my six dasher at 500 yards. My solution is going to probably tell me to dial 1.7 mils. Mm-hmm. And that's going to give me my elevation for the shot. Now, most people are not going to shoot or miss due to the elevation. They're going to miss due to their inaccurate wind call. So if I were to ask you, John, what mile per hour gun is your gun, would you know what I'm asking you?
No, but right. my system's different. Like, I can dial per miles an hour on my scope.
Right.
So I never really, I've been shooting that, the Best of the West stuff for, or Husqvarna scope stuff for like 12 years now. So I kind of like wind and all that stuff, like I don't really think about it as much anymore. It's kind of made simple stupid for me.
Mm-hmm.
So
the way it works is, you know, there's a deer bedded at 500 yards and you're shooting across the canyon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be, the wind is going to affect that bullet trajectory multiple times between you and the target.
Mm-hmm. Based on whether it's steady wind or gusts and all that. Yeah.
Right. And not only the wind, but the turbulence coming off the ground, the thermals coming off the ground. Right.
Okay.
So you've got heat waves coming off the ground as well that are going to push the bullet up, and the wind is going to push the bullet left, right, up and down in multiple ways. And that, where that wind is coming from, depending on where you're shooting from, can change, you know, 2, 3, 4 times, but from the time it leaves your rifle to the time it gets to the game, right? So that's where you get into ballistic coefficient. The higher the ballistic coefficient of the bullet, the less it's going to be impacted by wind. So I know what my gun shoots. I know the mile per hour gun that my bullet is. And when I say mile per hour, there's a solution for the wind speed as it affects the solution for the bullet. And I'll make it kind of simple here. So my gun is an 8 mile an hour gun. It's like, well, wow, what do you mean? How can a gun be an 8 mile an hour gun? So for every 8 miles an hour, so if I have a steady crosswind at 8 miles an hour, my bullet will drift 1/10 of a mil per 100 yards. So I shot, and every time I'm out and I'm feeling the wind, I have a Kestrel with me, and it's like, hey, what does that feel like? Or, you know, I put the Kestrel up, which is a wind meter. It says, that's a 5 mile an hour wind. Okay. How does it feel on my face? What does that look like on the trees? How does that affect the grass? Okay. There's a 10 mile an hour wind. What does that feel like? What does the grass look like? How are the trees moving? What's the dust doing? So I've gotten to the point where I can guess or estimate the wind within about 2 miles an hour. So when I'm shooting at a target or a game animal, I actually have my Kestrel. I'll measure the wind where I'm at. And if it's an 8 mile an hour wind, I know for every 100 yards, it's going to affect my bullet 1/10 of a mil. So let's do that math. So 8 mile an hour wind, I'm shooting at 500 yards. That's 5/10 of a mil. So when I'm shooting PRS, my first wind hold, if I believe it's a consistent wind, is going to be 5/10 of a mil into the wind, mm-hmm. and that's my starting point.
Okay, and then you adjust by whatever your spotter says, or
right.
Okay.
So in PRS, I don't have a spotter. I have to call my own.
Call your own. Yeah.
I have to call my own, and then for animals, obviously, you want to be dead on. You know, so
right.
I'm not going to take a 800-yard shot across a canyon with winds gusting from 9 to 18 miles an hour, because I don't know how it's going to affect it. I'm going to do everything I can to get closer to that animal if I can, or pass and wait for a better day. For PRS, I got to take a shot, and we have a thing called believe the bullet. So I may have 10 mile an hour wind blowing at my face from right to left, right? Mm-hmm. And I shoot, but my bullet is hitting differently than what I'm expecting it. Well, believe the bullet, because if I'm holding too much wind and my bullet's hitting to the right, well, then I need to take off some of the wind, or if it's hitting far left, then I need to add some wind. But people tend to, I don't know how many times I've come off the target and I put two shots into the dirt because I saw the first shot go into the dirt, uh-huh. and then I didn't make a correction because I thought it was a bad trigger pull, and then the next bullet goes into the dirt, and I just validated, yep, believe the bullet, and then the third shot, I'm on the target. So believe the bullet. And then another thing people don't understand is most people look at the target and see what the wind's doing at the target, and they don't give as much weight to what the wind is doing where they're at. So just think about a bullet is going 2,700 feet per second. If the wind is blowing from right to left at the last 100 yards of that travel in the bullet, that bullet is only being affected by that wind by 10ths of a second. Mm-hmm. The wind where I'm shooting from is immediately going to affect that bullet as it exits the barrel immediately, and it's going to send it on a trajectory for the entire distance of that shot. Mm-hmm. So if the wind is blowing from right to left where I'm at, but left to right where the target is, it has, say it's a 600-yard shot, it has 500 yards to be affected by that wind where I'm shooting, and only 100 yards by the wind downrange. Mm-hmm. So again, that goes back to believe the bullet.
Right. Now, as a guy who shoots a lot, do you have like an actual, it might sound kind of obvious what you're already doing, but like a practice regimen that you do? Like, I know what I do with wind. Like, I purposely go out constantly shooting in the wind during monsoon season, stuff like that, with my bow, right? So
right.
Like you, I'm not out there with a Kestrel, but I'm like, okay, this much wind, it's blowing like this, I need to hold like this, and it just becomes second nature. And that's just by me going out and practicing. But do you have a specific, drill or anything that you do specifically to?
Well, what I can, your listeners can do the pretty much the same thing that I do, and just go down, download the Hornady 4DOF app or the Applied Ballistics app. And that is a great starting point. You're out there and you're going to practice. Definitely, you got to practice, right?
Right.
So a lot of people just like to shoot when there's no wind because it's easier and they feel better about themselves. You need to go out when you got 10, 15 mile an hour winds and realize that sometimes you have to hold off the target. Sometimes you're holding and not even on the deer because you're shooting across a canyon and it's consistent wind, so you're confident of your shot. But you may be holding in front of the deer in order to hit the deer in the vitals, right? So get yourself one of those apps and start playing with it. Put your load data in there, and it's a good starting point. It may say, hey, this shot is 600 yards. It's telling you to hold 3 minutes of wind, right? Mm-hmm. And so then go practice. See how that works for you. See what 3 minutes of wind looks like. But you just need to get out there and practice. And this is a good, let me segue back to the caliber that you're shooting, okay? Mm-hmm. If you're shooting like I used to shoot a 300 Weatherby across the canyon at a bear at 500 yards, I pull that trigger and I've got my scope zoomed in, I'm lucky if I can see the side of that mountain after I pull that trigger, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the recoil, let alone stay on the bear. But now that I'm shooting, I shoot a 6.5 SOM, a 6.5 PRC when I'm shooting. And when I shoot, I can actually see where my bullet is impacting the animal or missing the animal and make a correction, because the recoil is such that I can still stay on the animal and I can see it. Now, on my match guns, I can actually see my bullet going down range. Mm-hmm. So you've been behind hunters, you set up your binoculars behind the hunters, they shoot, and you're steady on your tripod, you can actually see that bullet trace, right?
Right, yep.
So now I've been shooting so long, I can actually pick up that trace as well in my scope as I'm shooting.
Right.
And so you have to be able to see your bullet when you're shooting to make corrections. So those folks that are out there shooting their 300 Win Mags, 300 Weatherbys, 338 Rums, or 300 Rums, yeah, you get that one shot. If you hit, the animal's going down. But if you miss, you don't know whether you missed high, whether you missed low, too much wind, not enough wind.
I'm going to play devil's advocate with you. I don't have that problem. I can always, not always, but almost always see my bullets impact in the
but
scope.
But that's you.
I agree. I agree with you. When you have a super heavy kicking thing and it's popping off. And I think the thing that's kind of made me, have that ability more so than just a gun, because I was even getting it with my old Sendero, which was just a Remington Sendero, box gun. In the same caliber, 300 rum, is shooting off of Anthony's shooting bags, to be honest with you. And that's a little shameless plug right there. But honestly, the barrel control and the overall control of the gun, it makes a huge difference, like you said, to be able to see your impacts and to follow through,
Right. So in precision shooting, I've learned how to build a position. So precision rifle shooting, how has that made me a better shooter for hunting? In two ways. I now shoot, 1,000 rounds a month practicing for PRS as opposed to 100 rounds a year practicing for hunting. So
right.
I've built better form, but more importantly, I've learned how to build a solid position and I've learned to manage recoil, which now transfers into hunting. So I can, because I'm in PRS and we are limited in time, we have 90 seconds to get 10 shots off, and we may have to move 5 times or 10 times to get those shots off. I have trained myself to be able to build a solid position in minimum time. And I'm sure you've experienced this. I am able to find the target within a second, mm-hmm. After building that position. I'm sure you've been with many clients that you've tried to talk him onto a deer and he just can't find it in his scope.
Yeah.
Right?
That's one of the toughest things, especially with coos deer.
Right. Mm-hmm. So PRS has given me the ability to build solid positions and find my target. I can find a target at 500 yards in less than a second through my scope. And so, because I have to do that in PRS. Now, hunting, if that deer is bedded, then, I actually use Anthony's shooting bags in PRS for a rear bag because it's light. I don't use his bags in PRS because I want a heavy bag. My bag in PRS weighs 10 pounds, and nobody's going to carry a 10-pound bag for hunting.
No way. Yeah.
His bags are phenomenal for helping you build a position. Typically, out west, you're going to have a bipod on your rifle, so you're going to have that in the front, and then his rear bag is going to give you excellent stability to make that shot. If you can't lay out prone, then I've shown Anthony how to use a tripod with an Arca rail with his rear bag to give you rear support, and I had Anthony shooting with my 223 mm-hmm. hitting a 6-inch target at 1,000 yards with the 223 with nothing other than a tripod on an Arca rail supporting the gun and his, I believe it was large bag under his elbow, giving him rear support.
Right.
It's a
seated position. Yeah.
Yeah. Seated down with that bag under his elbow, the guns on the Arca rail. I've switched all my guns away from Piccaninny on the bottom to Arca rail.
Okay.
And then it's amazingly solid. I mean, Anthony was hitting a 6-inch target 1,000 yards with a 223.
Yeah, he actually had shown me that a couple of years ago. You know, told me that you showed him. So when I'm rifle hunting or when I'm guiding rifle hunters, I usually carry the medium bag. I carry the TBD bag and a small. That's kind of the combination, and it's easy for me to strap to my backpack. So we had a situation with one of the hunters, and it wasn't like super, super long shot. It was about 375, I think it was. And he was an older gentleman, and laying prone in that spot would have had to make him lift his neck up, and he couldn't lift his neck up because it was one of those where your legs would be a little bit higher than your body, and you got to kind of like arch your back to shoot prone. So I got him set up, seated with my tripod, you know, and I carry this one of those little Y deals with the base plate on it, and it just clip it all, you know, clip off my binos and clip that on so the gun rests on there, just like, you know, what you would find on shooting sticks type thing. And I sat him down, put my backpack across his lap, and put the medium bag on top of the backpack, and he was just sitting there perfectly still. And it was a bedded javelina at 375 yards, and we couldn't get closer unless we could get closer, but we'd had to get to like 50 yards to shoot him or less. And he was like, I just want to shoot him from here. I'm like, okay, we'll shoot him from here. And he was able to make that shot like that. That's a really cool one. Of these days I want to do like a Anthony's been talking about it too for a while, is to do a hunting situation, shooting tutorial, where to use the bags, like, you know, resting on trees and all that other stuff. But that's a really solid position. Anyway, a little off on a tangent, but you're reminded.
Well, no, that's a good segue for like, if there's outfitters or people listening or hunters that take their wives and kids, I highly recommend, if you ditch the bipod Piccaninny rail that goes on the front, switch over to an Arca rail on the gun, and then switch your tripod over to an Arca rail. And here's why I say that. Last year I took my wife, no, 2 years ago, I took my wife on a coos deer hunt. Anthony gave me a good spot to go. Sure enough, we glassed up a coos deer. Mm-hmm. Because the grass was so high, I couldn't get my wife proned out. So we had to literally run down the hillside to where there was a dead tree, and I was trying to get her on the tree. Uh-huh. She was all set up, and now the light's going down, and she just could not find the deer in the scope.
Okay.
She could see where it was on the hill because it was only about 400 yards away, but she just couldn't find it in the scope. So we came back home. We didn't get a deer that year, and we started practicing off the Arca rail. And so now the way we do it is I set the tripod up. That Arca rail with the really right stuff head will hold a gun. My match rifles weigh 22 to 24 pounds. And I can hook that into that head, lock it down, and it does not move. So our hunting rifle only weighs about, you know, 9, 10 pounds. So the way it works now is if she can't find it, I'll just get behind the gun. I'll put the crosshairs on the deer. Mm-hmm. I'll lock it in. I'll get out from behind the gun. That gun doesn't move. She can get in behind the gun, and now the deer is in the scope.
Right.
And now she can adjust to make sure that the crosshair is on the vitals before she pulls the trigger. And we practiced, and she was hitting 9-inch targets out to 1,000 yards by sitting down shooting off a tripod. And I don't mean it's like she hit it a couple times. She was hitting it like consistently.
Nice.
So
now that's huge.
Yeah, so if you're taking your son, your daughter, your wife, or whatever, and you struggle with finding it, you know, I went out with Anthony and his dad, and mm-hmm. it was so funny watching the interaction, because Anthony was getting so frustrated because his dad couldn't find the target in the scope. And it's like, yeah, this is me and my wife, or, you know, and everyone's been there.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds. That was me, 20 years ago when I first started hunting. Yeah. You know, more than 20 years ago. Geez, like, I keep forgetting I've been here for 30 years. But
I highly recommend that system.
Yeah. No, I can see how that's beneficial. I actually do the same thing with Anthony's bags, but now of course I have to rely on it being prone. Is I get I get in the gun, I get the scope on the deer, or basically the deer will be at the very bottom of the scope. So all they have to do is get in and squeeze the rear bag, and it drops the, you know, the crosshairs down on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do that all the time now. That has been our saving grace, for so many hunters.
Shameless plug for, Anthony, Phoenix Shooting Bags. He does sponsor me, but I tell you what, there's very few things I will turn around and go home for when I leave.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going hunting and I don't have this one product in my bag, I will turn around and go home and get it. And that is his seat.
Oh yeah.
If you glass out west, you have got to get Anthony's
the glass and pad. Yeah.
The seat pad. I mean, you can sit on the sharpest rock and you don't even feel it. It keeps your butt dry. I will literally go back home and get that thing. Usually I leave it in my pack.
I modified all my packs so that it clips onto the bottom.
I can't glass without those things. They're amazing. And then, of course, I always keep one of his small bags clipped. The orange one, I lost one of his green bags that he gave me because I was out hunting with a guy for antelope. He was using my gun. I had him on the bipod in the front, Anthony shooting bag in the back. It was camouflaged. He hit it. We're high-fiving. We went out and got it. Loaded the goat in the back of the truck, drove back to camp. The next day I'm like, oh crap. where's my shooting bag? And of course it's camouflage.
Right.
So everything I own now, because I have a severe case of CRS, everything I own hunting wise is orange.
Yeah.
So yeah. I can find it when I set it down.
Last year during you reminded me of a quick story. Last year during the rifle elk hunts, I had a client. And I used to call this the death hike because it's crazy steep and it's all like manzanita, like chest high. It sucks. It's a shitty, shitty hike. But we hiked all the way up to the top and my hunter took a shot at an elk and unfortunately didn't make the shot. And I had left my original TBD bag up there, which is the one that my aunt, Anthony's mom, had made for us originally when we were, you know, developing and helping Anthony put the stuff together. And I didn't realize that I left it up there until I was all the way back then. And I didn't sleep all next day. And I'm like, man, I'm going to just go up there tomorrow, even though the hunt was over. I'm like, and I hiked all the way back up there to get it. It was like, but I got it back. So anyway.
Yeah. Anthony made, I actually left one of his seating bags when I was 2 years ago glassing for javelina in the snowstorm. And I got back to my truck and realized, because it's that, oh shit, there's an elk and you know, he's behind a tree. So you grab your tripod and you get a better angle. And then you go another 50 yards, get another angle. And then you go another 50 yards, get another angle. And then all of a sudden you realize you've gone 400 yards and you're like, oh crap. And so I had to do the walk of shame back to Anthony. I was like, Anthony, I lost my seating pad. Man, please have another. But yeah, Anthony's, those seats are amazing. So I've got three right now, two with my embroidered name and one I'm not allowed to use because he made it for my wife and he said, I can't touch it. It has to, because that's for Kim. And he's afraid I'm going to lose that one as well.
Probably. So I want to talk about a couple other things too, real quick. Like, let's talk about scopes. What's more important to you, the quality of the glass or the mechanical function of the scope?
So let's just talk about a budget real quick. If you've got $2,000 mm-hmm. to spend on a gun and a scope, spend $1,500 a scope and $500 in a rifle.
Oh yeah, for and sure.
Because the old saying, cry once, buy once. Okay. When you're looking through a scope, you need two things. You need, the lenses have to be clear. It has to be able to gather enough light for those early morning, late night shots where you need to identify the game.
Mm-hmm.
And just as importantly, that gun has to track. So when I say track, it means when your ballistic solution tells you to dial 15 MOA,
it better be 15 MOA.
It better be 15 MOA on that scope.
Right.
And it needs to return to zero, okay? So you dial up to 15, then you dial back. And you can go out and do a check on your scope. And I always do it on all my guns, all my scopes. I'll draw, I'll I'll take a target out there. I'll set it at 100 yards. I'll take a level. Mm-hmm. I'll put a level line at the bottom and a level line at the top. And then I'll take a plumb line. And I do this after the target is in the ground. And that plumb line is making sure it's perfectly vertical.
Right.
And I'll draw lines all the way up the target based on increments for tenths of a mil. If you're shooting MOA, then you draw MOA lines. And so I'll make that first, I'll take a shot at 100 yards, and then I'll dial a mil. I'll take another shot at a mil, and then I'll dial up another mil. And I want to make sure that that bullet
is hitting those lines,
hitting at, you know, at the proper increments so that I know that my gun is tracking. And additionally, as I'm making that shot, I'm seeing where that bullet is tracking, because I want to make sure now that my scope is perfectly perpendicular to the center of the axis of the bore. And so I had a problem the other day where my wind calls were off, and I suspected that the wind wasn't off, my scope was off. And sure enough, when I put the gun on the scope, or when I mounted the scope, I use spur mounts, and they make it really easy to make it level. I was off by about a half a degree. Huh. And as I was shooting, my bullets were tracking further and further left with zero wind. And so I was able to see that I needed to just rotate that scope just slightly so that as I'm shooting, that bullet was tracking straight up that plumb line, as well as those bullets were laying on the horizontal lines to make sure that, you know, I shoot mil, so that it, 1/10 of a mil was 1/10 of a mil, and I tracked it all the way up. So you want to get a good scope, and the machining has come a long way in the last 20 years. So there are some great Bushnell scopes. Their high-end scopes are phenomenal for tracking. Vortex, the high-end scopes, their high-end scopes are known for tracking. My two favorite scopes that I shoot are the Night Force ATAC-R and the Leupold Mark V. Mm-hmm. I just absolutely love those scopes. One's a $3,600 scope, and the other scope is a $2,000 scope. I prefer the $2,000 scope, the Leupold scope, and it's a choice over the reticle. Mm-hmm. The glass is slightly clearer in the Night Force ATAC-R than the Leupold, but I shoot, it's essentially no difference, but the reticle, it's all about the reticle for me.
Right.
And the PR2 reticle in the Leupold scope. And they both, you know, when I say slightly better, we're talking the difference between, like, you're talking at the high end of scopes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the difference between a Lamborghini and a Bugatti. It's like they're both great scopes.
Right. Yeah. And I find, so with optics, you know, what I see with where you can tell the biggest difference, and everybody talks about low light and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Yeah. Low light. That's great. You know, half the scopes, all my Saguaro binos and all that stuff that I have. I mean, I could see in the dark. It's not going to help me any, because I really can't do anything. It's not legal to hunt in the dark. Right. So, but what really, to me, what sets a really high quality piece of glass versus one that's not, and this is the argument I always have with guys who are like, oh, I like my 15 Vortex binos versus, you know, and I'm like, look into the sun. When you're looking into this, you know, into the shady side of a hillside, you know, or a mountainside, whatever, and the sun is blasting you in the face, that halo effect that you get, that hazing, the better your glass is, the less of that you have. So how many times are you aiming, you know, at a deer or whatever across the canyon, and you're looking, you know, you found it with your binos, and you got to go to your scope now to find this deer in this, and your field of view gets smaller because you get vignetting and you get, you know, that hazy glare. It's that's where it comes into play. Like when you, I mean, I'm not going to badmouth. So like the one problem that I have with Husqvarna is on their older scopes that are not shot glass, it's kind of difficult to see into the sun. You know, right. It's not terrible.
So, just to be clear, when you say shot glass, just so your listeners know, that is the manufacturer. They're German glass manufacturer. Right. So when people look at scopes, it's like, oh, I got to get the biggest, baddest scope so I can gather as much light.
Yeah, light gathering.
I got to get a 56 millimeter scope, right? So the size of the objective is not necessarily what gathers the light. It's the lenses and the coatings on the lens that provide the light. So another issue that, you know, have that same person look through those binoculars or that scope into that bright sun and have them pull something out of the shadow while doing that at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to talk binoculars really quick, here's the issue. You know, again, buy the best glass that you can get. And so give you an example. You know, I don't want to badmouth any manufacturers out there, but, you know, some people that, you know, I've sat down to next in their glassing and they're using a brand of binoculars. They may be 15 power, 56, just 15 by 56s or whatever. And they're sitting next to me with my, by the way, best binocular for hunting, for glassing, you know, the Swaro 15 by 56s. I mean, you just can't beat them. The depth of field in those binoculars is so deep that I can pick up a deer. Let's just say I'm glassing a hillside at 600-700 yards. The depth of field in that binocular is so deep, I can pick up movement at 1,000 yards that I may have missed.
Right.
Over my other set of binoculars, where
you were focused.
And they're looking.
Yep.
And they're constantly focusing because their depth of field is so narrow that they missed that ear twitch or the buck got up for a second and bedded that down. It's blurry to him. He never picked it up. All right. So you want to look at depth of field as well as field of view. You know, the greater the field of view, the more ability you have to pick up that movement on the edge of your view, you know.
Right.
You know, just like you're sitting there glassing, the typical new hunter is looking for a deer. You are looking for an antler tine that moved or a deer that flicked, right?
Correct.
And so you need that fidelity to see in that glass that you're going to be able to pick up.
Yeah, no, for
sure. But yeah, if you have a budget and you can't afford that, then save your money until you can afford that.
That's exactly what I tell everybody. I made the mistake years ago. I mean, you have done it too. You know, you buy one thing and then you're like, oh man, this is not what I was hoping it would be. And then whatever, you paid $400 for it, you sold it for $300. Now
right. You
move to the next thing. Like I had like six different binos, you know, before I landed on the Saguaros, the original, you know, Saguaro Visions. SLCs or whatever, but you know, I mean, I had Fujinons, I had I had Zeiss, I had, you know, Nikons, and before that, I don't even remember what the company was, like a Russian company, you know, and I thought it was magnification and, like you said, magnification of objective lens. So I had these giant, you know, binos, and I just couldn't do what I do now, you know, with what I have. So.
Right. And so you can spend that money on a scope and you can take that scope and put it on a better rifle. You can't take that rifle and put it on a better scope. It's still going to be a crap rifle, right? But spend the money on that excellent scope and then you can take that scope as you are able to invest in a custom rifle.
Yep.
And you know, I'm actually sponsored by a rifle guy here in the Valley. Phoenix Custom Rifles, you know, and if you buy an action, like say an Impact or a Defiance or a Bighorn, the tolerances in those guns are so good that, and the barrel manufacturers are phenomenal, Bartline, Krieger, Brooks, Benchmark, the barrels are so good that gunsmiths can now build guns that I expect, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the standard benchmark was 1 inch at 100 yards.
Right.
You know, the benchmark now is we're talking quarter inch at 100 yards because of the manufacturing tolerances are phenomenal nowadays. I remember I was hunting with my an outfitter here, and I was shooting a 270, 150 grain bullet, with a 4-power scope at an elk bedded at 442 yards. And I hit that elk on my first shot. He got up and ran, and we had to do a couple follow-up shots. But that was in 1996, and we were like, I can't believe you shot that deer, that elk at 400 yards. That's, I mean, 442 yards is just over, it's 2 yards over a quarter mile.
Yep.
It's like we were high-fiving, like, holy God, such a long shot. Now we walk out and we're like, oh, thank God. It's
a slam dunk now. Yards. 400 yards is a slam dunk. Right. Yeah.
So in PRS, we have what they call a skill stage where we have to run up to a barricade, get 8 shots off at a 10-inch target. And so we run up from, we start back 10 yards, we run up, grab our gun, build a position on the barricade, and get 8 shots off.
Mm-hmm.
And I typically do that in about 45 seconds now at a quarter mile, because the ability of the stability of the bag I'm using, the accuracy of the gun, the clarity of glass, and, you know,
and the practice.
It's amazing where these folks, the manufacturing has come nowadays. So,
oh yeah. I mean, you see it in everything. Yeah, look at Bose.
It's a different game. Yeah. It's a different game than it was 20 years ago.
Look at Bose 20 years ago. I mean, I remember, and I'm going to sound like a freaking, like I'm tooting my own horn here, but I remember like 20 years ago going back east and hunting, and I would take people's money because I was shooting, you know, like 60, 70 yards at a target, and they couldn't even believe it. Nowadays, you know, you could dial a freaking pin to 150 yards and have the same accuracy guys were having at 50 yards 20 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
It's not because guys got better at shooting, you know? I mean, yeah, maybe some of it, but
the arrow
man, yeah, man, oh god, then, everything
back then you're shooting the Easton XX75.
Oh yeah,
you know, and now you're shooting
putting them on a straightener after every time you practice to make sure they didn't bend in the target.
You're shooting carbon fiber arrows with the broadheads that tolerances are phenomenal.
So it's crazy.
It's come a long way.
Crazy. Well, awesome, man. I want to thank you for coming on. Always enjoy picking your brain. I'm sure that the listeners got some good tidbits out of that. And you got any rifle hunts coming up? Or
no, I didn't get drawn for anything.
I was going to say, I didn't think you did.
So I did shoot a coyote the other day.
Oh, nice.
With I built a mom, actually, Keith built me at Phoenix Custom Rifles. He built me a .22 Creedmoor. And nice. I finally, my suppressor finally got out of suppressor jail. And so I took my wife up to the north rim of the Grand Canyon overlanding. And so we went out and we just kind of screwed around a little bit and called in a coyote at about 250 yards with that .22 Creedmoor. John, I wish you had seen this coyote. I shot hundreds of coyotes. Uh-huh. As you have. But I walked up on that thing and, you know, I've shot coyotes before I used to love my .22 250.
Right.
But this was the cleanest coyote. I thought I scared it to death. It was the cleanest coyote I had ever seen. Not only was there no blood on this coyote, there was not, you know, typically they defecate and pee
on
the fur. There was nothing. And then when I cleaned it, there was not a single flea.
Oh, really?
On this coyote. Not a single flea. It was the most pristine coyote I've ever seen in, you know, 30 years of varmint calling. It was amazing. It was beautiful. I love it. I've got it in my, skinned it out. I got it in my freezer. I need to tan it. Unfortunately, awesome. I skinned it out for just a pelt and I cut his paws off and I got home. I was like, oh man, I should have skinned that for a life size.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. If he was that good, huh?
Yeah. I asked my wife if she would mind a life size coyote come out in the house and she kind of gave me an eyeball.
I bet.
But my wife is awesome. She lets me put anything I want up in the house. So,
my wife doesn't have a choice. I don't let her.
So, if I can, you know, give any advice to your listeners is spend the money on the glass, on the scope, mm-hmm. get out there. Nothing beats practice. Get a gun that you're comfortable with. It's not how manly you are. A 6.5 Creedmoor is enough to kill anything on the lower U.S., including elk. 6.5 Piercy is a little bit better. It's about bullet placement. It's about practicing. It's about being comfortable with the gun.
Agreed. Agreed. Hey, real quick before I let you go, I want to tell you that 22 Creedmoor, I love it. I love that gun. Ask Anthony last year or this past spring. We were, you know, we had the boys out for javelina hunting, and I was hitting toe for toe with him in his six millimeter GT with that 22.
And there's no recoil on that.
Crazy.
Put a brake on it. It's like shooting a 22 long rifle.
Oh, mine has a brake on it. Yeah, mine's it's crazy. I was 1,300 yards with that, you know, little billet. What is that? 85 grain, I think it is.
I think we loaded you up the Burger 85 and a half grain.
Yeah.
I'm shooting, you know, right now components are nearly impossible to get. So I was able to get about 1,575 ELDM quantity. And that bullet is phenomenal. Super accurate, super consistent, performs phenomenally on game. You know, I wouldn't hesitate on taking that. I remember when I first met Anthony, but I wouldn't hesitate using that 75 grain bullet on a coos deer out to 300-400 yards. I remember I met Anthony, I don't know, 6 years ago now. And he's like, you know, he was asking me recommendations for his 243. And I gave him my recipe that I use for antelope. And I probably shot 20 antelope with the Burger 87 grain VLD out to 500-600 yards. And he's like, you're shooting an 87 grain bullet on antelope? I go, it's like lightning hits him.
Yep.
And he started shooting the coos deer with that. And I don't think he's had one take a step.
Nope. Yeah.
You're shooting an 87 grain bullet at about 3,300 feet per second.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when that bullet hits the deer, it creates what they call hydrostatic shock. And that hydrostatic shock basically shuts down the electrical system in the game. And it turns them off, and their butt will hit first, and then their front legs collapse. It looks like they got hit by a lightning bolt.
Yep.
I love that bullet, yeah.
Well, that's pretty damn awesome. All right, Dave, man, thank you for coming on, man. I appreciate it. I will talk to you soon, and maybe we'll get out and do some coyote hunting here soon.
Yeah, good luck on all your hunts this year, and maybe you can help me this year. I have dedicated this year to finally shooting a mule deer with my bow. I've shot hundreds of whitetails.
Yep.
But for some reason, I cannot. And of course, I passed on a bunch of deer.
Yeah, well, your eyes were big for a while, man. I remember going with you a couple of times. You know, you're so like, I'm not going to go after that. He's only like 130, 140.
I'm looking for a Boone and Crockett Forky. I got to break the curse of the mule deer archery. Yeah. So that's my goal this year.
Yeah, I get that, man. I do that. I had to do that with blacktails. Like, you know, I kept going for this one size in my head, and I was like, you know what, this year I don't give a shit if it's legal. I'm shooting it, and I'm just gonna that's it. I'm done. I'm getting over this. I leave tomorrow for Utah. I have that Books Cliffs hunt.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to turn one up, and I'm gonna bring the rifle. Originally I was thinking about bringing my bow, but I'm trying to get back as fast as I possibly can so the wife doesn't divorce me, because I got a 10-day guide trip in South Dakota after that. Not 5 days after I got home. So
happy wife, happy life.
Yeah, exactly. All right, brother.
My wife's eyeballing me right now. All right, Jess.
I'll talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.